From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If there is one motto that defines our age, it's keep it real. When so much of our lives have been packaged and test marketed and all but shoved down our throats, we crave the genuine, the authentic. Whether it's real ethnic food or singer-songwriters who sing from the heart or politicians who are what they say they are. But is this cult of authenticity really all it's cracked up to be?
Too many politicians, too many consultants now are trying to manufacture authenticity.
What happens with punk is that you get people emphasizing authenticity at the same time as creating elaborate personas.
I think authenticity has very limited use these days. You know, some of the best sushi I've had is at very high-end restaurants by either French chefs or French-trained chefs.
So, should we just forget about authenticity? Or is it still worth striving for what's real? A few years ago, cultural critic Richard Todd became obsessed with the whole idea of authenticity. As he looked around and saw how much of modern life is manufactured and mediated by other people telling us what's real, he concluded that authenticity is less a condition in itself than a desire. And he wrote a book called The Thing Itself, On the Search for Authenticity. Anne Strainchamp talked with Richard Todd.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the ways in which this particularly American hunger for authenticity permeates our culture. You begin the book by telling a story about a day you bought a little wooden antique box at an antiques fair. Do you want to tell that story?
Well, yes. It was nestled in a group of antiques that I took to be from the 18th, early 19th century, and I bought it for what was really, in retrospect, an outrageous price, $200. And as I started home with it, I realized that something was troubling me about it. And by the time I took it to an antiques dealer friend of mine, it became plain that the box was an utter fraud. It might have been 2 or 3 weeks old. Indeed, my friend thought he knew the actual maker who was turning these things out by the dozens. Of course, it still was a kind of nice little box.
Oh, I was going to say, you felt cheated, and yet the box was the same, supposed. I mean, the qualities that drew you to it, the paint, the color, the design, it's still the same box.
Exactly. But the box was lying to me. It was not what it pretended to be, and it was not really a reproduction. It had actually been sort of made in a way that was meant to suggest that it was something it wasn't. And so I felt a bit conned.
Well, but that raises this question about, you know, what is authenticity and why we value it? I mean, in this case, in terms of antiques, why are antiques valued in the first place?
It's not an easy question. It's very interesting. I discovered in the course of this that the vogue for antiques is really quite recent. In the late 19th century in England, people suddenly became very interested in antiques. Before that, antiques were simply old furniture. At that point, it was a response to manufactured things. And antiques had the distinction of bearing the mark of an individual human hand. Of course, my fraudulent box did bear the mark of a human hand, too.
Just a hand that's still living.
Yes, exactly.
You would have preferred a dead hand.
I would have preferred a hand from the grave, exactly.
But there is something to that, though. You know, all the different meanings we ascribe to different levels of supposedly authentic objects. You also write about travel and places and the ways in which we somehow see some places as real and others as less real. Well, for instance, tourists traveling in another country, you know, Italy, say, get very concerned about whether they're seeing the real Italy.
It does seem to be a universal anxiety. And part of it has to do, much of it has to do with our expectations. Obviously, if they're within the borders of Italy, they're seeing the real Italy. So they may not like the real Italy. They want, often, I say they, I've been one of them, God knows, we want the Italy of our imagination.
the weird thing about the way one feels as a tourist looking for, you know, the real Italy or the real France is it's a place where you're not going to run any risk of encountering anyone else like you. You know, so for instance, the real Italy is always a place where there are no other American tourists.
Well, part of it is the wonderful fantasy of the undiscovered place, even though you probably have made your way to the undiscovered place by virtue of a guidebook. But nonetheless, you hope to push a few miles further and find some place that is uninhabited or is unvisited by people like you.
So on the one hand, you know, you can page through a travel magazine and see all kinds of articles enticing you to visit supposedly authentic, pristine, real places. And you turn the page and there's another article suggesting that you visit a place that is the essence of artificiality, Disney World, or maybe Las Vegas.
Yes, well, I've been to both those places. I rather like Las Vegas. I've been a travel writer and I've written about both places, and Las Vegas has a kind of honesty to it. The difference that I find is that Las Vegas doesn't want anything from you except your money. And Disney World does want something from you. It wants you to believe in something, a vision of the world as a kind of cute place that I find hard to take. And my reaction, I must say, was embarrassing, because what is an easier target than Disney? And I thought I was just going to go down there and chuckle all the way through, but I actually find it quite impressive.
There's also the question of what's authentic in our public culture. The topic of authenticity came up a great deal during the last 2008 presidential campaign. Somehow we wanted our politicians to be who they said they were, and then were outraged by revelations of what seemed like hypocrisy. Well, John Edwards' affair, for example, seemed like the exact opposite of authenticity. What do you make of our sort of obsession with authenticity in politicians?
Well, without being an apologist for John Edwards, I do think we put rather impossible demands on our public figures because, in effect, we want them to have no private life. We are only satisfied when we think we are seeing the total person. And there has to be something that stands apart. We have to recognize that there is a public person and a private person. Certainly, we want them to be in some way consistent. But I'm not sure we're entitled to everything that there is to know about everybody. But the way our world is set up at the moment, we seem to think so. And politicians get themselves in a great deal of trouble by seeming to promise that they are giving us all of themselves.
Richard Todd is the author of The Thing Itself, On the Search for Authenticity. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Sherman Alexie is a celebrated fiction writer. He's also a Spokane Indian with strong opinions about what it means to be a real Indian. It's a question that keeps popping up in his short stories. Steve Paulson asked Alexie to read an excerpt from one story, The Search Engine. It's about a young Indian woman who's gone off to college.
Corliss didn't want to live with a white roommate either, no matter how interesting he or she might become. Hell, even if Emily Dickinson were resurrected and had her reclusive hermit unrequited love addict gene removed from her DNA, Corliss wouldn't have wanted to room with her. White people, no matter how smart, were too romantic about Indians. White people looked at the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, the full moon, newborn babies, and Indians with the same goofy sentimentalism. Being a smart Indian, Corliss had always taken advantage of this romanticism, but that didn't mean she wanted to share the refrigerator with it. If white folks assumed she was serene and spiritual and wise simply because she was an Indian and thought she was special based on those mistaken assumptions, then Corliss saw no reason to contradict them. The world is a competitive place, and a poor Indian girl needs all the advantages she can get. So if George W. Bush, a man who possessed no remarkable distinctions other than being the son of a former U.S. president, could also become president, then Corliss figured she could certainly benefit from positive ethnic stereotypes and not feel any guilt about it. If she lived with a white person, Corliss knew she'd quickly be seen as ordinary, because she was ordinary. It's tough to share a bathroom with an Indian and continue to romanticize her. If word got around that Corliss was ordinary, even boring. She feared she'd lose her power and magic. She knew there would come a day when white folks finally understood that Indians are every bit as relentlessly boring, selfish, and smelly as they are. And that would be a wonderful day for human rights, but a terrible day for Corliss.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, you really have it out for white people, white liberals who like Indians. That keeps coming up in a lot of these stories.
Oh, I have it out for everybody. You know, I made fun of George W. in that paragraph. I made fun of liberals. I made fun of Indians. No, I have it out. Everybody's ridiculous. I'm misanthropic.
But in particular, it seems like some of the ideas that Indians are especially spiritual or that they're close to the earth.
Well,
I mean, all of those.
Yeah, the idea that we're special is ridiculous. You know, the whole New Age movement is based on as many stereotypes as genocide was. So it's just, you know, two sides of the same coin. I just think it's funny. You know, when these New Agers show up on the res looking for a highly traditional and sacred Indian man, and you wouldn't believe how many Indian men suddenly become highly sacred and traditional.
So there are plenty of Indians on the res who want to play that role.
Yeah, who, you know, become highly sacred and traditional in the presence of highly attractive German women. Indian guys with the one tooth, you know, becoming shaman. They start flossing that thing. It shines. But we're all that way. I mean, we're all human beings. We're certainly going to take advantage of the opportunities presented us. And Indians get those opportunities. And, you know, what's so wrong with that? I mean, we've been, you know, abused and genocided and oppressed and lied to and distorted and destroyed for centuries. So if you know, some Indian man or woman gets laid now and again because they're Indian. So, you know, it's certainly, it's still not even. It's still like, you know, 8 million to 1.
That's fiction writer Sherman Alexie talking with Steve Paulson. Alexie read an excerpt from his book, 10 Little Indians.
I know I'm faking it. I'm not really making it. This feeling of faking it. Shaking it.
Questions about authenticity reach way beyond politics. Take music, for instance, where hip-hop artists vie for street cred and talk about keeping it real. And the history of other genres, from folk to blues to punk, is filled with fights over who's genuine and who's not. But music critic Yuval Taylor told Steve Paulson that this cult of authenticity is actually full of holes. Taylor's the co-author with Hugh Barker of the book Faking It: The Quest for Authenticity in Popular Music.
If you're in disco, you're not really concerned about authenticity. It's a very hedonistic kind of music. The same thing's true with rockabilly. On the other hand, if you're doing punk or folk, these are musics that have a certain moral sense to them. Honesty tends to be very important for these musics, so honesty goes hand in hand with the idea of authenticity there.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I wish you were all night too.
It seems that this whole question of authenticity plays out especially powerfully in folk and blues, and you go into some detail talking about one of the legends in folk music, Lead Belly, the black singer who was discovered in a prison in the South by the folklorists John and Alan Lomax. But the question of Lead Belly's authenticity is actually quite problematic, isn't it?
Yes, it is. John Lomax promoted Lead Belly as, well, as one newspaper headline put it, a murderous minstrel. You know, there was this idea in the early 20th century, which I think still survives today, that the most authentic thing you could get would be pure id, the untamed savage. And Lead Belly was, for many people, a symbol of that untamed savage because he was a murderer. He was in prison several times for attempted murder, and yet he was a singer who seemed to sing from his soul. He had a rather primitive guitar playing method and somewhat primitive singing method too. But Lomax distorted this in many ways. He made Lead Belly wear penitentiary clothes and prison clothes for his performances rather than a suit, which is what Leadbelly wanted to do. He limited Leadbelly to performing only what he considered authentic folk songs rather than the pop songs of the day, which is what Leadbelly wanted to perform. And he treated Leadbelly with a lot of condescension. Richard Wright said something to the effect that John Lomax treated Leadbelly as if he was his slave. So it's a rather complex story.
And in fact, didn't John Lomax actually, once he had gotten Leadbelly out of prison, didn't he have Leadbelly working essentially as his personal servant? I mean, he was shining shoes and fixing exactly. Lomax's coffee.
That's right, and driving him around. Yep. And Leadbelly turned around and sued Lomax. So he got his own, I guess.
And yet it's more complicated than that because without the efforts of the Lomaxes, we wouldn't know anything about Leadbelly today, would we?
Well, that's absolutely true. And Leadbelly has proven enormously influential. And what's interesting is that people for whom authenticity is very important, such as Kurt Cobain of Nirvana, cite Leadbelly as an influence. I mean, Kurt Cobain called Leadbelly his favorite performer and performed one of his songs as a kind of swan song on his last record, MTV Unplugged. So he's referencing the kind of authenticity that Leadbelly stood for without realizing its complexities.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pines.
Well, tell me about how Kurt Cobain performed a famous Leadbelly song. It was Where Did You Sleep Last Night? What did Cobain do with that song?
He did this thing that Robert Johnson used to do where you sing one verse in one register and then shift it up an octave when you do the reprise, and that imbues it with so much passion. Leadbelly sang it more or less straight, and Kurt Cobain imbued it with this drama that's very gripping. I don't know if it's any more or less authentic than Leadbelly's version, but it's just as good for sure.
My girl, where will you go? I'm going where the cold wind blows. In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I would shiver the whole night through. My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night?
Kurt Cobain's band, Nirvana, was famous for trying to carve out their own sense of authenticity. I mean, they argued vociferously against the commercialization of the music industry, and this seemed to torment Kurt Cobain himself.
Yes, it certainly did. I mean, in his suicide note, he talks about not wanting to fake it and wanting to keep it real and feeling unable to do that anymore. You know, it's not as simple as to say that authenticity killed him. Obviously, heroin was involved as well as guns, but it certainly was a factor.
Well, it raises fascinating questions about what we mean by authenticity, then. Are we talking about music that goes back to some, quote, pure roots? We can talk about what that sense of purity or uncontamination means. Or does authenticity just mean a singer who's bearing his soul, who's showing us vulnerability and raw emotion?
Yeah, it does get back to that question. I mean, and that brings up two things in terms of this particular performance. Kurt Cobain was showing us a tremendous amount of emotion in the performance, and I'm sure that emotion was genuine. Yet, as any performer knows, you have to summon that emotion out of somewhere, and it's not necessarily what you're feeling at that particular moment. If he were to be really genuine, maybe Kurt Cobain would have sung about what it was like to be under those hot Klieg lights on a TV stage. The other question is, what race is this song? Is it black? Is it white? Is it some combination? When Lomax found Leadbelly, he was embarking on a project to search out the true Negro folk songs and to try to find performers who were isolated from whites. That's why he went to all black penitentiaries, because he thought that performers there would slough off the white idiom and become truly Negro. obviously, that's quite a fantasy, and Leadbelly got his songs from all sorts of sources.
Now then, on the other side of the racial line, there's Jimmie Rodgers, the legendary country singer, the so-called father of country music. But again, he himself was profoundly influenced by black musicians, wasn't he?
Yes, and he performed the blues. And when the person who recorded him, Ralph Peer, first heard him perform blues, he said, well, that's nigger music. That's not going to fly. You know, white music and black music don't mix. And of course, his first hit record was Blue Yodel, a blues song, and it just eclipsed everything that had come before. It was such a huge hit and was so profoundly influential. And he made a career of singing these blue yodels, which are basically blues songs with some yodels thrown in after the chorus.
I'm gonna buy me a shotgun with a great long shiny barrel. Gonna buy me a shotgun with a great long shiny barrel. I'm gonna shoot that roundup that stole away my gal.
Now, it would seem that another musical genre where authenticity is absolutely crucial is punk.
Oh, yes.
Do the issues play out any differently there?
Yes, they do. What happens with punk is that you get people emphasizing authenticity at the same time as creating elaborate personas. The early punks all used stage names, and then they started dressing and acting to try to match their stage names, all the while saying that they were being as authentic and honest as they could be, and they were a big change from the rest of the 70s. So you get Sid Vicious turning into a rather vicious musician. Johnny Rotten, or John Lydon, adopted the stage name Johnny Rotten, then went back on it, abandoned Rotten, and decided to be himself again when he formed Public Image, which was a band almost devoted to exposing the kind of shams of punk. And then you had other bands, Susie and the Banshees, or Tom Verlaine, or Richard Hell. I mean, everyone was adopting these stage names to position themselves as something that they weren't, all the while claiming that they were being more honest and authentic by doing so.
And sometimes this would catch up to them. I mean, Sid Vicious seemed to believe this nihilistic stage persona that he'd taken on. He ended up killing his girlfriend and himself.
Yes. Well, I don't think he killed his girlfriend, but I guess that's still an open question.
So should we just get rid of this whole idea of authenticity in music?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that it has its uses. What we should do is discuss more honestly what the component of authenticity is. For example, I think we should use words like sincerity rather than authenticity when that's what we mean. Or we should use tradition if that's what we mean.
By sincerity, you mean does the performer really mean it, or is it just an elaborate show?
Right, exactly. And autobiography is another very useful term, I think. Some songs are clearly autobiographical, some are not. But what's nice about authenticity is that the quest for it, that people striving to be more authentic, has produced some amazing music.
Give me some examples of that. I mean, what comes to mind in particular?
Oh, I think Kurt Cobain and Neil Young are the people that come to mind immediately.
So how does that play out with Neil Young?
Neil Young was trying to be as immediate and in the moment as possible. His whole concern is with being real, being more real, in his words. And he did this most effectively in his album Tonight's the Night, recorded in 1973, where he got everyone pretty drunk and stoned and had them switch instruments and play first takes and make a lot of mistakes. And it produced a really raw, ragged recording that sounded unbelievably immediate, as if you were right there. And he was singing about the deaths of his friends, and the whole record sounds like a wake. It's a really amazing moment in popular music history, and I don't think it would have happened without Neil Young's constant striving to be authentic.
Although the answer is not unknown,
goodbye. And the world on its string doesn't mean me.
That's Neil Young's rendition of World on a String. Yuval Taylor is the co-author of the book Faking It, The Quest for Authenticity in Popular Music. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, more in our examination of authenticity. Does it make sense to talk about real Chinese food? And are some Indian writers more authentic than others? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Not many obscure writers can rake in $1 million advance for a new book, but that's exactly what Vikram Chandra did when his novel Sacred Games set off a bidding war among New York publishers. It's a monster of a book, a 900-page thriller about Indian gang lords and a Mumbai police investigator. It's launched Chandra into some very select company, Indian writers who've gained international reputations. But, like Salman Rushdie and Rohinton Mistry, Vikram Chandra has also faced a nasty question. Is he really an Indian writer? After all, Chandra lives half the year in America, and he writes in English, the language of the colonizer.
I grew up in post-independence India, being aware of the past of English and how it came into the country. But in the schoolyard, with my friends who were from all parts of India, we spoke English with a mixture of Hindi or Gujarati or something else thrown in there. And it seemed to me then one of the languages in my world that I could use and therefore be able to twist it and change it. And I started writing pretty early. My mother is a screenwriter. And so I watched her writing as I grew up. And when I was 11, I had this urge to start writing down the stories that I was making up in my head. And I just naturally wrote in English.
Well, later, did it begin to bother you that you were using this language that had been imposed on your culture by others? Did it seem inauthentic to you to write in English?
Not really, because I think India is a place full of variety of languages, all of which come from various sources. For instance, Urdu or Hindustani, which is the spoken language of the last couple of 100 years or 300 years, comes from a mixture of Persian and local dialects, local languages. And the word Urdu actually comes from Ordu, which is the Mongol word for soldier's camp. So apparently it started as a soldier's patois and then became, amazingly enough, the language of refinement and the courts and love. So I think languages have interesting ways of moving through the world. What is once foreign to you then becomes your own. And that can be a painful process, but I never felt that I was betraying anything by writing in English or speaking in it.
But there is this, I suppose it may be just academic criticism of you. I know that you've written an article called The Cult of Authenticity, right, defending yourself against this. The people who make the criticisms must feel them. They're not just making it up out of nothing. Is there some sense in which they feel that you and other successful Indian writers are betraying the homeland in some way?
Well, I recognize where it comes from. I guess what I reject is the sort of nativist back to the soil element of that argument, implying that a person who lives in an urban area writing in English is anyway less real in their experience or their perceptions than somebody else who lives elsewhere and speaks Bengali. And I think that's attaching, valorizing one kind of experience over the other. And I think the arguments about authenticity finally recede endlessly into the past, because which authentic India are you talking about? Is it the pre-colonial India? Because everything we are now and that we do has certainly been affected by colonialism. And if you're talking about pre-colonial India, are you talking about pre-Mughal India then? Because the Mughals came in from somewhere else. So it ends up in this awful trap, I think. It's interesting, actually, since I wrote that article, I wrote it about the Indian context of this argument, but I've had writers and artists from all over the world speaking to me about this. A Basque writer in Spain, for instance, who faces the same questions about selling out, in a sense, you know, to the majority Spanish culture. Or when I taught at Breadloaf a couple of years back, a young black woman who talked to me about the same kind of tension about who are you writing for, what's your audience, how authentic are you, and what's your street cred, in other words.
Well, I have to say, as a Western reader who's already confessed that Hindi is not one of the languages I speak, if you didn't write in English, I would have no hope of introduction to society that you write about. So yours is as close to authentic Indian writing as I'm likely to see.
And I'm not pretending to any special authority at all. I think even when one writes about, say, a city like Bombay, there's no sense in which you can produce some sort of last version of it, the authentic one. So I like to think that what is contained in the stuff that I write is a darshan, which is a Sanskrit word, which means vision or view. And so the idea is that every one of us has a certain darshan of reality, and each one is perhaps valid or real as the other one. And I think that's all we can hope for from art.
Do you feel at all distanced from what it is that you write about? You spend, what, about half of your life in Bombay and half in Berkeley?
Yeah, it works out to about, I think, 7 months in Berkeley because of the way the semesters run, and about 5 months in India. And for me, I think maybe because I left home very early and I had this urge to go to foreign places, going away from home has been a very productive way of thinking about what home is and what it means. And I think maybe artists have always traveled for this reason, that when you encounter the foreign, it teaches you a lot about how specific and local you are.
So living in Berkeley makes Bombay come more alive to you in some ways.
Right, right. And when you go back home, you see and smell everything that was invisible before because you're unfamiliar with it all over again.
The professor who criticized you vociferously and got you to write The Cult of Authenticity, though I'm sure she didn't intend for that to happen, do you still feel at odds with her and with those she represents? Is there a view of common ground you might find?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I should also say I was younger and very angry when I wrote that, because it seemed like a lifetime of listening to that kind of criticism, that kind of thinking. And I would probably do it in a different way now. It became quite a polemic, that article, which I'm not disowning, but I think the question still remains alive. And I hear it every now and then in different forms in public and private discourse in India. In other words, especially since we've liberalized the economy and the media, and what was once very far away and foreign has come flooding in, the question of who are we exactly, who am I, and what am I becoming, becomes even more urgent. And I think the most creative or the most satisfying solutions I've seen include a multiplicity of selves within the possibility of what is Indian, so that even within the same person you contain, I think, many selves. And certainly the context where you're interacting changes that. And then I hope that in a secular, democratic way, we can actually agree to be different and yet part of perhaps a greater whole.
That's Vikram Chandra, author of the novel Sacred Games. Well, if we can't talk about authentic Indian writers, can we at least talk about real Indian food? Or for that matter, authentic Chinese or Mexican food? Well, that's also a problem, as food writer Barry Glasner told Steve Paulson.
I used to think, you know, there are authentic ethnic restaurants, you know, there's an authentic Thai restaurant and an inauthentic one, you know, there's an authentic Chinese restaurant and an inauthentic one. I got to go to the authentic one. What I discovered is that the differences are mostly in the minds of people who think the way I used to, you know, that one is just, you know, some sort of grossly Americanized version of the food, and the other is the way it was back in the old country. And what you really find is that there are different forms of authenticity. Some of the best dishes in ethnic restaurants don't go way back, but they're very authentic. They were created by chefs and cooks and people who care a lot about food from the culture in question. They use ingredients that are near and dear to people in those cultures, and they're delicious, but they may not have been consumed 100, 200, 300 years ago.
But maybe we should just get rid of the whole word authentic then. Maybe it just doesn't mean anything when it comes to talking about food.
I think authenticity has very limited use these days. It's hard for me to think of examples where you can really rely upon it. Now, the notion that we were trying to get at, or that we try to get at through this, I think is an important one. You know, we do want to know if we are from outside a particular culture or cuisine. You know, what is it that makes this cuisine great and is characteristic of this cuisine? Those are important questions to ask.
Right. When you walk into a Chinese restaurant, it's always encouraging to see a number of Chinese patrons there. I mean, you think, okay, maybe the restaurant is getting it right, or, you know, translated to a Thai restaurant or a Vietnamese restaurant, same kind of thing. You assume there's a certain level of authenticity there.
I think that's right. Now, today, of course, some of the finest restaurants that serve foods that come from particular ethnic traditions, ethnic cuisines, have made their way into other kinds of places. So, you know, some of the best sushi I've had is at very high-end restaurants by either French chefs or French-trained chefs. Now, why is that the case? Well, in some cases, when I asked the chefs, it was very clear right away. That's what they enjoy eating when they get off work. You know, they live in places like, you know, London. They've been to Tokyo a lot, or they've worked in Tokyo and so forth. And, you know, this is what they enjoy eating themselves. And so they've sort of tutored themselves and incorporated elements of those cuisines in their own work. So, you know, in that way, too, it gets complicated, right? Is the finest sushi preparation, the fact that it's in the hands of a French chef, does that make it less authentic? I don't think so, and I don't think a great sushi chef in Tokyo would say that either.
Well, and then there's also the question of whether Americans want truly authentic food, if we define authentic as being cooked the way it is back in the home country, especially when it comes to spicy food, because we know that a lot of Americans just don't like very spicy food.
Well, in some cases, I talked to the chefs and owners of restaurants that are considered very authentic, you know, the ultimate authentic place, you know, by people like followers of chowhound.com and others, and, you know, and writers who are very interested in authentic ethnic cuisine. And what I was told time and again is, you know, my American customers don't really want that. In fact, I've had to change it in this way or that way. And these are not random American customers. Moreover, you know, in some cases, it's just very difficult for them to get some of the ingredients that they would need to prepare the food the way that they would have in their home country or the way their grandmother would have done it. And to get those ingredients, then, you know, you would have to fly them a very long distance, which creates other problems. And finally, you know, what they point out to me a lot is that a wonderful benefit for them in being in this country is that they have access to other ingredients that work beautifully in the recipes and that they love working with and that they see as just, you know, kind of integral improvements in their cooking.
I totally understand your critique of this cult of authenticity in food, and yet there's still a part of me that wants to find that restaurant run by, let's say, a Peruvian chef who's just come from Peru recently and is now living in the city where I am and cooks in a way that seems to come straight out of Peruvian cuisine. Am I just misguided here?
I feel the same way, but the way I would put it is a little differently, right? I would love to see what that person is cooking right now, right? And compare it to some other great Peruvian food that I can find. And then I'd love to come back in a year and see if it's changed, and in 2 years and see if it's changed. You know, so to me, it's a kind of evolving matter, and it's not so much about the authenticity of it, which I suspect would be hard for that person to defend even him or herself, right? You know, is there an ingredient that the chef's grandmother on one side of the family uses and the chef's grandmother on the other side of the family doesn't use, or that they use in different amounts in a particular recipe? You know, it gets very complicated when you really get down to what's involved in the cooking. But the quest for really wonderful taste experiences and for expanding, you know, my culinary horizons is unending for me, as I think it is for many people.
Barry Glasner is the author of the book The Gospel of Food. He talked with Steve Paulson. So, should we just get rid of the whole idea of authenticity? If you want to weigh in on this question, send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We'd love to know what you think. Coming up, we'll hear from members of the Canadian folk rock band Great Big Sea, who are not shy about calling their work authentic folk music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Ellen Doyle, Bob Hallett, and Sean McCann are the founding members of the band Great Big Sea. The band has its roots in Newfoundland and takes Newfoundland traditional music as its launching point and raison d'etre. With a huge following in Canada and a growing number of fans in the U.S., Great Big Sea has done something a little surprising. They've proven that folk music can rock. Their newest CD is called The Hard and the Easy. Alan Doyle and Bob Hallett stopped by the studio to talk about the album and its first track, Come and I Will Sing You.
It's a song that I, like many Newfoundland songs, I've just always known. And Bob used to always sing it late in the nighttime. And we went to look around, and it's much older than Newfoundland, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the oldest songs in the English-speaking world, really. Its antecedents go out of, you come back 700 years and then you run out of printed sources. It's that old. Here's a song of my family that, you know, was from another time and another place. It was like seeing Robin Hood in the back of your yard. You know, that's what it felt like, right? The magic of it has never really gone away from me.
Come and I will sing you.
What will you sing me?
I will sing you seven. No.
What will the seven be?
Seven senators under the sky, six pallbearers, five firemen under the bush, four gospel preachers, three of them are drivers, two of them are little white babes clothed all in green. No. One the one that's all alone forevermore shall be so.
When you started out, you were singing Newfoundland folk songs. You still are.
Yeah.
But to the world at large, it doesn't matter particularly that they're Newfoundland.
I know.
Folk songs.
That's right. And I think that's true for a lot of folk musicians. You know, part of our, you know, passion, I suppose, as semi-academic folky types, we're really interested in the history and the authenticity of the music is often what you find most appealing about it. You forget sometimes that in show business, people just want a good night out. And they could care less that that song you just sang is an authentic tale of a, you know, a shipwreck that washed ashore in 1587, and that the verse in the second verse is actually about a real person named Doug who did, you know. Look, just get to the next song, dude.
But, well, Bob is looking at you as you're...
Well, I was going to say, the corollary of that is true too as well, though. I mean, if we had been doing somebody else's songs, you know, say we had chosen to perform Irish music, as many, you know, people who want to adopt that culture, choose to do, I don't think we would have been as successful, because one of the things we do have that separates us from any others is authenticity. Nobody else was singing and is singing these songs, you know? Mm-hmm. A lot of them we learned from friends and neighbors. So, I mean, we had this repertoire that other people don't have, and that gives us authenticity. And in the world of folk music, authenticity is gold.
So where did these songs come from? I mean, are they from your childhood? You heard these growing up?
Well, different songs came from different places, but certainly there's a canon of Newfoundland folk songs, just like there is a canon of Irish folk songs or Southern English folk songs or French folk songs or Quebecois folk songs, you know, and in each of those cultures, in Newfoundland as well, there are songs that are immediately available. They just, Lukey's Boat, I have no idea I ever sat down to learn to sing that song. It just somehow comes with the birth certificate. You just know it, like, you know, it's just everywhere.
Well, old Lukey's boat is painted green, hi, me boys. you've ever seen. Me boys have been lying.
But still other ones we sought out. For example, a friend of ours would say, you know, there is a song about, you know, the logging tradition in the Midwest part of Newfoundland that it's something about a river driver. I heard it one time at a party, but and then you go try to find it. Yeah. And that's a cool pursuit as well, you know, to uncover some of the lesser known but equally authentic songs from the traditional canon.
I'll eat when I am hungry and I'll drink when I am dry. Get drunk whenever I'm ready, get sober by and by. And if this river don't drown me, is down I'll mean to roam. For I'm a river driver and I'm far away from home.
So you both remember listening to these when you were growing up, and you've added to the canon as you've gone along.
Well, I mean, we all grew up in houses where people sang and played music habitually. There was no really performance attached to that. You know, it was just something people did, like reading a book, you know, or playing checkers or walking the dog. It was just part of life, and we really took it for granted. And many people of our age, you know, grew up in houses like that, you know, and as a result, I suppose it wasn't until we were much older and we started doing this for a living, we realized how amazing that was, you know, to grow up in places where music was taken for granted, where this was a skill that people had, like, whittling, you know, that they did not take it, and they took it very casually. No one ever said, you really need to learn these tunes, it's really important because they're old. That didn't happen. It was, you can learn whatever you want, you can play whatever you want. What's important is that you participate in the entertainment.
But when did it begin to be important to the two of you then to realize what was in these songs?
I didn't realize that it was a special thing until I was in my early 20s. You know what else I figured at the time, you know, as in my late teens? Well, let's go to Toronto and let's listen to the traditional Toronto music. And you become flabbergasted to find out that, well, there is none. And not everybody has this, you know, this canon of recorded history in song. And what, well, you know, what's in our own backyard is not only spectacular to us, but it's unique in the world. Like, and I certainly didn't know that till I was...
I could sell this.
Yeah, that's right. I could make a buck singing sea shanties.
My name is Captain Kidd. As I sailed. Oh, my name is Captain Kidd. As I sailed. My name is Captain Kidd. And God's laws I did forbid. And most wickedly I did as I sailed.
So you're singing these songs that are Newfoundland's roots.
Yeah.
Music. And then you start playing rock.
Well, we're lucky to come from a place where folk music isn't approached very academically. It isn't seen certainly as a static and fixed thing. And people, you know, in Newfoundland and Labrador, luckily for us, you know, didn't treat Newfoundland music, you know, as a university course. They didn't sit in the back of the meet on Thursday evenings from 6 to 8 to talk about the sea shanty. And so, you know, they were just there and around. And they were often sung, you know, in my house growing up in the kitchen party. My dad would sing, you know, a Newfoundland traditional song. Then my uncle would sing an Elvis song. And then my other uncle would sing a song that he wrote that afternoon. And then around she'd go again. And there was never any discussion that one song might be of more value or different value than any of them. It was all just songs. And it was all just about facilitating the celebration that you're in at the moment.
The perfect Great Big Sea album, you would not be easily able to tell the difference
between one and the other.
And you know, just expand on what Alan said, I mean, the Newfoundland tradition is not orthodox. You know, to draw an analogy, it's nothing like bluegrass, where there is a fixed and static form of bluegrass. And to be good at bluegrass is to get as close as possible to Bill Monroe and, you know, other kind of early purveyors of music. That doesn't exist in Newfoundland. What's important is to be entertaining.
So did you make this switch? I mean, I know you still perform both kinds of music. When you decided that you were going to do a little more pop music based on folk music traditions, did you do it at home first? Did you first perform those, or did you go...
Nah, right out on the stage.
I was Great Big Sea has evolved in front of paying ticket holders, unfortunately, for the crowd. All of our experiments, musical and otherwise, have happened under the lights. And I honestly, that's true, and I'm unashamed about that. You know, we've never been the kind of band that workshops stuff forever before we tried it out, you know, it's primarily because of the fact that we just played so much, and our apprenticeship came from the pubs of Atlantic Canada, where if you're not a fearless performer, then you're gonna die. You have to be willing to try everything constantly, all the time. And if someone in the back, You know, we'll buy a round of pints if you'll sing a Don McLean song, or if you'll sing a Metallica song, then you bloody well better sing it.
You ever perform Metallica on stage?
Yes, actually, I have.
Not so much myself.
Yeah, it doesn't go good on the bouzouki.
Just come back to the song for a moment. Is there one that you go to when you know you've got to make the next moment count?
There's a dozen songs in our kind of common critical repertoire. We know that will work everywhere, anywhere. English-speaking, non-English-speaking, you know, blowing a gale, blowing a gale, raining, no rain, gear, no gear. We know these songs will work.
Excursion Around the Bay works everywhere.
You know, so we always fall back for those.
Knock on wood. Hey, knocking on wood. You know, the chorus of Excursion Around the Bay goes, oh me, oh my, basically repeat. And, you know, With clapping.
And you're not going to forget those lyrics.
No, it's a cool song about... an old traditional Newfoundland song about a mishap, basically. Again, about a tragedy where someone dies. And about a bunch of guys leave St. John's to go around the coast to Harbour Grace on a... the full title of the song, I believe, is the Harbour Grace Excursion. Anyway, the wife of the speaker gets pulled on the ship, and as is true with every sailing ship that ends up with a woman on it, some disaster happens. And she dies. Anyway, and it's... it's a funny song, actually. I'll jokes aside, but the chorus is oh me oh my.
Doesn't sound funny.
Let me see if I can figure out the chorus. Oh me oh my, I heard me old wife cry. Oh me oh my, I think I'm gonna die. Oh me oh my, I heard me old wife say, I wish I'd never taken this excursion around the bay.
Oh me oh my, I heard me old wife cry. Oh me oh my, I think I'm gonna die. Oh me oh my, I heard me always say, I wish I'd never taken this excursion around the bay. Oh me, oh my, I heard me always cry. Oh me, oh my, I think I'm gonna die. Oh me, oh my, I heard me always say, I wish I'd never taken this excursion around the bay.
Ha! Alan Doyle and Bob Hallett are founding members of a Canadian folk rock band, Great Big Sea. Their CD is called The Hard and the Easy. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, send us an email through our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Authenticity Show. It's number 613A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.